afternoon, everyone. Thanks so much for coming to my talk. I'm currently a faculty member in the Division of Adolescent and Young Adult Medicine at Boston Children's Hospital and in the Department of Pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. I'm going to be sharing with you today some of my work looking at substance use risks between youth with and without chronic medical conditions. I do not have any conflicts of interest or financial relationships to disclose. I'm sure many of you are aware that adolescence and young adulthood are times of peak risk for onset and intensification of substance use behaviors. This is some data from the Youth Risk Behavioral Surveillance System survey, looking at substance use among 12th graders. It's a cross-sectional assessment of both ever use of the three most common substances, alcohol, tobacco, cigarettes, and marijuana, as well as some heavier or more problematic use behaviors, including binge drinking in the past 30 days, ever being a regular smoker, and marijuana use in the past 30 days. And as you can see, the prevalence of all three of these substances is quite high in terms of lifetime or ever use among 12th graders. So certainly, this isn't necessarily new behavior, and we have a lot of reasons to care about substance use, or this isn't new information, these high prevalence estimates, but there are a lot of reasons why we want to continue to look at this research or these use behaviors. We saw in the last presentation that alcohol and tobacco can be associated with development of chronic disease later in life, and we also know that these risk behaviors co-occur with other risk behaviors that can pose immediate or short-term threats to health. But interestingly, while we have pretty decent knowledge about the prevalence of these behaviors overall during adolescence and a little bit to a lesser extent among young adults, we haven't really had any expansive studies that look at whether or not there are differences in these use behaviors among people who already have a diagnosis of a chronic condition, so a pediatric onset chronic medical condition. I think anecdotally, there are probably a lot of people who might say, oh, if you have a patient who has pediatric onset asthma, it would make sense that they wouldn't be using tobacco or marijuana, but there really wasn't a lot of empirical evidence to speak to whether or not that was actually the case. So that was really what we wanted to do here, was to look specifically at a national sample of youth with and without chronic medical conditions as they transition from adolescence to adulthood, so spanning the really important age ranges of like 14 all the way up through 26, and look at whether or not those substance use patterns were different by chronic condition status. In order to do this, we used data from the panel study of income dynamics, which is a really great resource and actually pretty underutilized for health research. It's used quite widely in the economics literature. It was actually a cohort study conducted by the University of Michigan that started in the 60s and follows families as well as their children on and is actually still collecting data. And in 1997, they administered the child development supplement, so of the families who were enrolled in the original sample, if they had children between the ages of 0 and 12, in 1997 they were eligible to be included in this child development supplement. And then this supplement was administered at two additional time points among those youth who were sampled into the original cohort. And then in 2005, they added this transition to adulthood supplement, which is sampling from the youth who were initially in the child development supplement but who had turned 18 and transitioned to college or graduated from high school. And there are four total follow-ups. So this is a cohort that was started in 1997 and followed at multiple time points. And they're actually still collecting data on this cohort as well. So it's a really unique opportunity to look at a large sample of youth as they move through adolescence and into young adulthood and to look at longitudinal patterns of these types of behaviors. So in our final sample, we ended up with just shy of 3,000 youth who were interviewed in at least one of the follow-up PSID survey waves and up to five between the ages of 12 and 26. So the substance use outcomes that we're looking at here are the three most prevalent substances, alcohol, tobacco, and marijuana. And we're looking both at a lifetime prevalence of ever use, so for alcohol, ever drinking beer or wine or any sort of liquor without parents present, reporting ever smoking tobacco cigarettes or ever using marijuana. And we're also, again, looking at those more problematic or regular substance use behaviors, so binge drinking, regular smoking. And marijuana, we don't really have a great standard definition of what constitutes problematic use, so in lieu of that, we relied on using report of past month use without a doctor recommendation. So the independent variables that we're looking at in these models, of course, as I mentioned, the primary objective of this study was to quantify substance use behaviors among youth who both have and do not have chronic conditions. And so here's a list of all the chronic conditions that were asked about. Unfortunately, they don't the two different supplements that we're combining data from, the child development and the transition to adulthood, don't consistently ask about all these different conditions. So there's a little bit of heterogeneity, and also this is quite an expansive list, as you can see. But certainly we feel like this is going to be encompassing of many of the major, most prevalent pediatric onset chronic medical conditions that we might expect to see during these age ranges. We also wanted to adjust for other important confounding variables, including age, sex, race, ethnicity, various indicators of socioeconomic status, including parents' marital status, parents' education, and participation in women, infants, and children, or aid to families with dependent children, which are social services available to low-income women during their pregnancy. And we also wanted to look at psychological distress as measured by the widely used and validated Kessler-6. We relied on multivariable logistic regression to look at five different age period age ranges and determine the period and cumulative prevalence of both ever use as well as problem use, conditional and any use. And so we broke those age periods or age ranges out into less than 14 years, 15 to 17, 18 to 20, 21 to 23, and 24 and older. And also because this is a probability sample, we used survey weights and accounted for the complex sampling design. So these are just some overall lifetime prevalence in the entire cohort, and I'll just take a second to orient you to this slide. So this is over the entire period of follow-up, reporting ever using any of the substances. So the taller of the bars or the lighter colored bars represent ever use, and the darker, shorter bars within those represent, among those ever users, what is the prevalence of the more regular problem use. So for example, if we're looking at these tobacco, and then, sorry, the bars on the left represent the prevalence estimates for youth without chronic medical conditions, and on the right, the prevalence among those with chronic conditions. So looking at tobacco as an example, we see that 47% of youth with chronic medical conditions, or YCMIC, ever tried smoking during follow-up. And then 36% of YCMIC were ever regular smokers. So you might notice that alcohol has the highest prevalence of ever use, but actually when you consider how many people who report ever using actually progress into more problematic use, it's less than 50%, whereas when you look at tobacco, that has the lowest overall prevalence of ever use. However, it has the highest prevalence of problematic use among those people who do try cigarette smoking. So there's some interesting patterns, again, or differences in when you look at onset and then intensification of separate outcomes, which I think is important to consider. So I'm going to present now the multivariable results. So from the multivariable logistic regression models, we output predicted probabilities, marginal effects, to say adjusting for all those covariates that I previously mentioned, what is the difference between youth with and without chronic medical conditions look like once we've taken out the effect of those confounders. And these charts very much mimic that last one, where the lighter bars in the back represent the ever use prevalence, and the darker bars that are inset within them represent the more problematic or regular substance use. And this is presented use behaviors across those five time periods that we investigated. So the first thing I want to direct your attention to is that when we're looking at youth with chronic medical conditions, they have slightly higher prevalence, cumulative prevalence of ever use in later years, whereas they were more likely to engage in problem use, and this is for alcohol, so problem use here is binge drinking, where their prevalence of binge drinking among those who report ever using alcohol was significantly higher in younger years, although the magnitude of those differences is a little bit smaller than we see in later years, but those are where the significant differences were. For tobacco, we see that there are borderline significant differences for younger adolescents. So for those less than 14 years of age, we see slightly higher prevalence estimates of reporting ever using tobacco among youth with chronic medical conditions compared to those without. And then in later years, so young adulthood, we see that there is higher cumulative prevalence of ever being a regular smoker among youth with chronic medical conditions compared to those without. And finally, for marijuana, we see that ever use of marijuana is higher for youth with chronic medical conditions in this pre-adolescent or younger adolescent period, whereas more recent use of marijuana is more prevalent once we get into older ages among youth with chronic medical conditions compared to those without. So just briefly want to touch on some of the limitations of this study. While it is a nationally representative population-based sample and a longitudinal cohort, we're looking at sensitive behaviors, reporting on sensitive behaviors, so social desirability bias may yield underreporting of these behaviors in this sample, and particularly so perhaps among those with chronic conditions who may be more aware that they should not be engaging in these behaviors. So the fact that we found differences might, in fact, if there is differential misreporting, could lead to conservative estimates of the differences between these youth. And also, while we have a fairly large cohort overall, some of the specific conditions that we looked at, for example, diabetes, is a relatively small prevalence, and so it becomes challenging to get precise estimates of the effects across all these multiple time points for some of these specific diseases. And while we did break it out, we did some cluster analyses and looked at some larger groups that we felt we could reasonably combine together, and we still see that they're not statistically significant, but the magnitude of the effects are certainly in the same direction. So we think that that's pretty compelling that there might actually be elevated rates of substance use for a lot of these youth. So substance use, including regular and heavy use among youth with chronic medical conditions during both adolescence and young adulthood, is a substantial concern, I think particularly in light of the potential for disease exacerbation and health harm. So it's not just that smoking is bad for your health generally, but for example, if you have asthma, smoking can be particularly bad for your health, or if you have diabetes, using alcohol might be particularly problematic or complicate managing your treatment regimen. We did observe that there were really peak risks for experimentation and intensification during transition years. And I actually didn't point this out, so I'll go back real quick. But you can see that these are cumulative prevalence, right? So the steepest slope in terms of the increase in these prevalence estimates is kind of pre-age 20, right? So that's where we see the most people starting from year to year. And then once you get into the early 20s, you don't see a lot of new users. So that highlights the fact that these late adolescence, early adulthood transition years might be a key period of time for which we can try to intervene and prevent the onset of new use. And I think that there's also some really important implications when we think about recent health reforms. So the Affordable Care Act has expanded coverage for preventive services, including smoking cessation, as well as some of you might be familiar with the dependent coverage expansion provision, which allows youth to stay on their parents' insurance through age 26, which might allow them to have a more consistent contact with a provider, improve continuity of care, which might facilitate them receiving these type of services, and then could translate into impact or into changes in behavior. But I think one of the important takeaways certainly is that we do need increased case detection as well as novel interventions that are specifically targeted to medically vulnerable youth and speak to their unique challenges that they face in managing their condition as well as still engaging in normal developmental processes. Thank you very much. I just want to acknowledge my funding sources, and please feel free to email me or tweet me with any questions that you have about my presentation.
Papers open for questions.
I have a comment on the classification. The classification of problem drinking, normal drinking, no, I can agree.
Mm-hmm.
But tobacco use, any use, according to me, is a problem.
Any use?
Tobacco use, any use is a problem. So classifying, you know, some use of tobacco is not a problem. Some use of marijuana is not a problem, I don't think. I cannot agree on that, even the argument. Any even single use of tobacco is harmful. You know, you understand, you are presenting that, you know, some use of tobacco is not harmful. It's not problematic. So that argument, that classification itself has the problem.
I definitely see your point. I think that was probably a poor word choice on my part. I would agree that any use is certainly problematic. I think there are also kind of, you know, tiers of use. There might be, and unfortunately, the way that these survey questions were asked, like, for example, the ever tobacco use, it doesn't really differentiate between having one puff of a cigarette or having an entire pack. And some surveys rely on, let's say, have you ever smoked 100 cigarettes in your entire life to be considered an ever smoker? But this really just asks, did you ever have even one puff of cigarette smoking? So that's a little bit broader, but I still think that that potentially can be problematic, and there's probably not very many people who just had one puff and then said, I mean, maybe there are, but I think that we really aren't able to tell with this data set. So really wanted to also not only say what's the ever use, cumulative prevalence of ever use, but also say, well, among those who really are engaging in very, very problematic use behaviors, what does it look like? And, you know, we see fairly similar trends among both of those operationalizations of these use variables, although there are those, you know, slight differences. But I definitely see your point that that's, we have to recognize that any use, in particular for youth with chronic conditions, can be very damaging.
Other questions?
Given
this
being more interested in, you know, the action comes out of it,
absolutely. So I think anecdotally, when I presented this to clinicians, I have received a lot of, I can't believe this, I thought my patients with this chronic disease would never use, like, I didn't even think I had to ask or screen because they know better. So I think that the first step is kind of making providers aware that this, in fact, is going on among their patients with chronic disease, and so they do need to be screening them just as they would a healthy adolescent in a primary care clinic. But then I also think that there's probably another layer to that where you have these kids with chronic conditions that potentially see multiple providers, both, you know, primary care and specialty care, and there might be some confusion about who's responsible for screening for substance use behaviors. There really aren't any established guidelines that say, you know, if you're a pediatric endocrinologist, you should be regularly asking your patients with type 1 about this. They might say, oh, I'm sure that my patient with type 1 is going to be talking to their PCP about this, and I'm just going to have to talk about their, you know, treatment regimen in our 15-minute visit. So I think kind of clearly defining whose responsibility it is, and I think also recognizing the fact that even though a lot of these kids with chronic conditions do see multiple providers, there are probably a large number of them who maybe rely on their specialty provider as their source of primary care as well. So not assuming that they're going to be seeing that this can all be taken care of in primary care, but really figuring out what providers are these kids going to see, you know, and making sure there's communication between those providers about who is asking and providing counseling around these use behaviors. So I think that hopefully once we move towards the medical home model and better care coordination, that will be, you know, facilitate those types of behaviors. But I think right now we're just not quite there yet, and it is unfortunately going to require some pretty sizable systems changes to really facilitate this type of screening and treatment for these use behaviors, which I think also many providers might see as kind of secondary as far as importance relative to the other, you know, things that they have to discuss in the span of a 15-minute clinic visit.
Other questions? I have a couple.
Yeah.
So one is about, you know, are you familiar with any systems, EHR systems that are doing specific notification to providers that are providing care to kids who have chronic diseases? Anything that you could recommend on that end?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So there's a lot of work that has been looking at this ESPRT, so screening and brief referral to treatment. But as far as I know, it hasn't been, the recommendations are relatively new and it really hasn't been widely implemented. And I'm not entirely sure if there are any systems in place that have it universally programmed to their EHR to just pop up. And one of the, some of my collaborators have been working on is looking specifically, is ESPRT effective for youth with chronic medical conditions? Because again, there might be kind of complicating factors in terms of, you know, what is a problematic behavior for someone who doesn't have a condition and might trigger the ESPRT screen. Well, maybe the threshold should be lower for youth with chronic medical conditions. But we don't really know, so it's kind of a wide open area where there's unfortunately not good evidence base to support one screening tool versus another, but certainly something that we're working towards looking at. But I think also, you know, a lot of clinicians could just decide to, you know, universally try to discuss this with their patients in the absence of, you know, a validated screening tool. I think that they shouldn't necessarily feel they have to wait for ESPR to.
No, they need this particular system that could help them do the right thing, or at least say, no, I don't need to do this at this time.
Yeah, and I think that would be, you know, actually pretty easy to program into an EHR, kind of a pop-up, especially one when you have some of these integrated systems and you can share records between specialty and primary care. So saying, like, this person was seen but not screened, so please do it. And
right, because the kid's not going to be exactly able to, you know, say, oh, and by the way, do you want to talk about my smoking while we're here with my type 1 visit? So
exactly.
It's, you know, the systems approach might help. I was wondering if there's any qualitative research on maybe overload for kids with chronic conditions, and, you know, at some point you just sit there and go, the list is just too long. I'm trying to manage my blood glucose, and I just don't care about that.
So. Yeah. So also some of the, my collaborators are also working on this, and we have done a small qualitative study, and it was more kind of about how they can use with chronic medical conditions conceptualize, you know, these behaviors in the context of their disease. But I was a little bit surprised that a lot of them, yeah, don't necessarily think about it as much. They're like, well, I have a lot of other, I mean, not surprised by that, because they do have a lot going on in terms of managing their disease. I think
this is only one part of their life. They're going through adolescence. So.
Yeah, exactly. But I think what I was really surprised about, at least for some of the kids that we spoke with, was thinking, especially the ones who weren't presently using, that they thought that that was going to be kind of easy to maintain as they transitioned off to college. And I thought that, I don't want to be pessimistic about it, but I thought that they were maybe a little bit naive about kind of the prevalence of these behaviors once they, you know, leave high school and go on to college. And so I think that there certainly is a lot of opportunity for providers to kind of have these discussions with youth who might not be then prepared when they encounter this experience in college. And as we see, you know, the transition years, even through, you know, the late teens, early 20s, we still see, you know, new cases of substance use behaviors. And so certainly it doesn't end once they finish high school.
Yeah, I think that transition part is really fascinating. One last thing, it's just a plug for you in the APAJ section. So I don't know if anybody else was at the marijuana panel yesterday looking at the policies related to marijuana use. But I was wondering if you use state of resident as an adjustive factor here because of the implementation of different marijuana policies.
Right, so that's a really good question. So most of these data are actually prior to legalization or decriminalization policies that happened in more recent years, except for probably the last.
California was like 96.
For the decriminalization?
For their first medical marijuana.
Right, so yeah, so that's, okay, so we do separate out medical marijuana usage here versus use without a doctor recommendation, and so I think I kind of glossed over that, but the marijuana use here was reporting non-medical marijuana use. There was a very small number of youth who reported medical marijuana use, but it did occur. And we didn't adjust for state of residence in these analyses, but I think certainly that's going to be more and more relevant moving forward with
some of the papers presented yesterday definitely would show some likelihood to maybe look at that now.
Yeah, I think that's a really great suggestion, something we can certainly look at moving forward.
Last comment? Thank you very much.
Thank you.